getting our arms around stopping HIV in Africa,
Zika virus infection and the risk of microcephaly,
studying suicide in the army more closely,
and does publicly reporting mortality rates change them?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 3rd, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn to JAMA Psychiatry? That's this close look at timing of suicide among Army enlistees, shall we call them? And hopefully giving us some understanding of when and where that takes place and a place to intervene.
Suicide attempts in the U.S. Army have risen in the past decade, and you're absolutely right. Understanding the association between the suicide attempts and whether the soldiers have been deployed, as well as the method of suicide and the timing, can give us insight how we can best offer care to these individuals and hopefully prevent the suicide attempts. What the authors did was they did a retrospective study of regular Army enlisted soldiers that were on active duty between 2004 and 2009. During that time, there were over 1.6 million enlisted individuals. There were approximately 9,600 suicide attempts. Now, you might think it's more likely to be among individuals that were deployed. That's actually not the case. 60% of the suicide attempts were by the 40% of enlisted men who were not deployed. Interestingly enough, among them, they were more likely to attempt suicide at the second month of their enlistment. Contrast that with the 40% of suicide attempts conducted by people that were deployed overseas, either currently or previously. Now is more likely to occur either about 5 or 6 months into their deployment or 5 to 6 months after they returned back to the United States.
Okay, so does this suggest to you that there are times during which an index of suspicion should be higher?
Absolutely. For example, suicide attempts decrease the longer that somebody was in the military. The other thing it tells us is when people first come back from deployment, they may not exhibit some of the signs or symptoms that should lead us to suspect they could be at risk. Those may develop 5 or 6 months later. And what sort of things increase the risk of suicide attempts? Well, if they have PTSD or depression or substance abuse, especially in the month preceding the suicide attempt. In fact, 75% of the people that attempted suicide exhibited one of those behaviors before. The other thing that I think was interesting is it was much more common in women.
Wow, that's kind of interesting. And did they use methods such as firearms, which we know are much more common in men?
Although people that were deployed were more likely to use them than those that weren't because they had access to them, still less than 5% of the suicide attempts were with firearms. Most of them were with overdoses.
I'm wondering how this is a reflection of the increased suicide rate we're seeing just among the general population.
Well, this suicide rate is even higher than it is among the general population, Elizabeth. Armed with this information, it's important that we really pay attention to this because this is a serious issue with our enlisted men and women.
Very much so. From here then, why don't we turn to another serious issue in Annals of Internal Medicine. Gosh, we've been trying for quite a long time to stop the progression of HIV infection in Africa. Where are we?
Well, this is a study that reports the anticipated clinical and economic effects of what's the 90-90-90 program in South Africa. The goal is to diagnose 90% of people in South Africa that have HIV, that 90% would be treated with standard therapy, and that 90% of those would have suppression of the virus. Altogether, that means about 73% of individuals with AIDS in South Africa would have viral suppression. Contrast that to what's going on now, when 2/3 of individuals that have it are undiagnosed, and those that are diagnosed, only about 1/3 receive medication, and only about 1/4 actually receive virologic suppression. Economically, it's going to cost, over the course of 10 years, about $16 billion. You say, well, that's a lot of money. Over the course of 10 years, this will avert over 2 million HIV transmissions.
Well, and as we've pointed out so many times, this transmission of HIV is not a local phenomenon. It's a global problem.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't just stay in South Africa. To put it into perspective, we talk about something being cost effective if it costs $50,000 per quality adjusted life year. If you do the math here, it's $1,260 per year of life saved. So it's extremely cost effective.
Sounds like something well worth supporting. Since we're in Annals of Internal Medicine, let's turn to another interesting public issue, public reporting of mortality data.
public reporting is seen as really a powerful way to improve quality. And initially, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, did process reporting. And that is, did they do best practices in terms of antibiotic therapy and treatment of heart attacks and pneumonia? And that was done from about 2005 to 2007. With that, we saw improvements in processes across the hospital. Well, from 2008 to 2012, they also publicly reported not only processes, but mortality. And the thought being is that when mortality was reported, public release of information would actually drive lower mortality across hospitals, but nobody's ever examined it. So what these authors did was they looked at mortality among over 20 million Medicare beneficiaries that were hospitalized between 2005 and 2012. What they found in their studies was when they reported the mortality figures publicly, there was no additional increase, and nor was any difference across the different types of hospitals. This suggests that changes in mortality did not occur as a result of public reporting.
Okay, I'm not exactly sure why we would have hypothesized that public reporting of mortality data was going to have an impact on mortality.
Well, your skepticism seems to be well-founded, but there was a lot of thought that if people found out they could choose between four or five different hospitals and the risk of dying with a heart attack was higher in one hospital than another, that A, they would choose the better hospitals, but more importantly, the ones that were performing poorly would dig down deeper and say, gosh, why is our mortality so much higher and what can we do to make it better? It tells us we're probably focusing on the wrong thing if we're going to continue reporting mortality publicly and expect to get any benefit from it.
I guess the other thing I think would be interesting would be an assessment among the public of whether this data is used in selecting a hospital at which to receive care.
And in fact, this study didn't address it, but other studies have suggested that most individuals don't look for publicly reported data regarding mortality and don't know what to do with it once they see it, by the way, because comparing mortality in hospital A and hospital B are very different because the patient populations and conditions are different, even with risk adjustment, which is hard to explain. So I agree with you. I don't think it's something that most people examine when they're looking at where to be hospitalized.
Interesting. Finally, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. What about a closer look at Zika and microcephaly?
So the authors looked at the 2013-2014 Zika outbreak in French Polynesia. Prior to this, they had a baseline level of how often microcephaly or neurologic abnormalities occurred in that patient population. And then they were able to examine the number of cases that were reported during that time period. By looking at the number of cases and modeling what they thought of how many people were infected by doing an analysis of the serum looking for the immunoglobulin of the virus and modeling of how often it would cause potentially microcephaly, they determined that the incidence is somewhere between 1% to as high as 13%. It's more common in the first trimester, but it can occur in the second or third trimester as well. Now, the implications for this worldwide are phenomenal, regardless of whether it's 1% or 13%, because it's not only microcephaly or a small head, but there are accompanying neurologic abnormalities that you and I have discussed on previous podcasts. So this is a very serious worldwide issue.
It certainly is. I guess my question about this would be, in the real world, having this model validated.
And again, this is the first study to try to estimate it. There's still a pretty wide range. 1% versus 13% is pretty wide. It suggests that there's still more work that needs to be done, but it does suggest it's not an insignificant issue. You say, well, what should individuals do? Follow travel advice by the country's health authorities. If you're going out in the day, protect yourself with mosquito repellent, long sleeve, lightly colored clothes. The other thing to remind individuals is when they travel to countries that may have a higher incidence, is to practice safe sex or safe intercourse. To either use a condom, because it can be spread either from the direct bite of the mosquito or from sexual contact in the first 30 days after someone's been infected. So either to abstain from sex or to use safe sex practices. And then if you're traveling to a country, is choose a place that has air-conditioned accommodations where the windows and doors are usually kept closed, mosquitoes can't enter the room. And they should avoid cities or towns that don't have pipe water or have very poor sanitation.
And something, of course, that we're going to hear more and more about as this thing develops. Of course, the potential good news is that there are some vaccine candidates out there.
There's a lot of stuff going on right now, and I agree with you. We'll probably hear more about it as additional studies are done and as we receive more information about vaccinations.
Okay, so this week on the blog, I'm going to do the suicide among the Army enlistees. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.